call to order this meeting of the Commerce Committee. It looks like we do have a quorum. I think our we'll hold off on the minutes for the moment. The first and only item on the agenda, therefore, is House File 2. I will move House File 2 be recommended to be referred to the Workforce Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. And Representative Frazier, I understand you have an author's amendment, the A33 amendment. I will move the A33. It's my assumption this gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. And I would, if you don't mind, like allow staff to kind of walk through what the amendment does.
That is fine by me. Are we thinking Ms. James would do that? Ms. James? I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, Martha James from House Research. Let me just pull up my notes. It'll just be 1 minute.
While you do that, we have Vice Chair Katisa Watoon here, so I'll go to Vice Chair Katisa Watoon for a motion on the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the March 29th minutes.
Representative Katisa Watoon moves approval of the minutes from March 29th, 2023. Discussion to the motion. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes from March 29th, 2023. Are approved. Ms. James.
Mr. Chair and members, so I will just briefly walk through the A33 amendment. It is a lengthier amendment, so I'll just high level talk about some of the changes. So the beginning of the amendment makes some changes regarding allowing insurance carriers to offer paid family medical leave products. That's at line 1.2. Lines 1.9 to 5.2. Make some language clarifications from the Department of Human Services regarding the PCA program and how premium payments for the family medical leave program would be covered. There are several changes in the amendment related to definitions for private plans. That is a section later in the bill, but these would affect the definitions of benefit year and one other definition. But that's at lines 5.3 to 5.24. There's some other definitional changes, and on page five and six. On lines 6.6 to 6.9, that makes some changes regarding healthcare providers. Line 6.12 to 6.25, that is the, again, another definition clarification for serious health conditions. The amendment makes a number of technical changes on page 6. That's most of the changes on page 6 are technical. Page 6.29, or line 6.29 to 7.5, clarify how the exigency leave is included under the 12 weeks of family leave. So qualifying exigency leave is generally considered military. Also has language related to a 7-day qualifying event. On page 7, there are some clarifications regarding the use of PTO or temporary disability payments. And then moving to page 8. Sorry, there's a lot of changes here, so I'm trying to summarize as I go here. There's some clarifications regarding employment protections and eligibility for the paid family medical leave programs. There's also a clarification about what will constitute certification from an employee regarding a leave. There's a number of other technical changes on page 9. There's some language on page 10 related to, again, reinstatement. So when someone returns from leave, reinstatement to the same or similar job position. There's some language related to construction workers and employment protections for them on page 10. There's, again, a further language related to insurance, how this would work with self-insured private plans. on page 10. Several other changes related to the insurance industry on pages 11 and 12. And these, again, relate to the private plans to the extent that they're using an insurance product for those. There's a, on line 12.18, there's a clarification that the premium rates, so the premium rates that will be adjusted each year would need to be set by July 31st. There's also some clarifying language on page 12 related to supplemental payments. And finally, there is a new article added, Article 3, that would require an actuarial study to be done on the new paid family medical leave program.
Any discussion to the A33 amendment? Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to flag what looks like maybe a technical error in the drafting on 6.29. We're deleting the entirety of subdivision 5 and then adding a subdivision 5 with just an A and not a B. So just wanted to flag that for cleanup.
Well, we'll...
Unless I'm reading that wrong, it looks like there's just an A that needs to be deleted.
Let nonpartisan staff digest that. I don't, Ms. Baines, if you have a comment on that.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. So at line 6.29, I do see what the representative is speaking about. So it looks like there does need to be a paragraph B, I believe it perhaps at 7.1. That's something that I can certainly clarify with the reviser to make that correction. But it is the new subdivision 5 is replacing the existing language, so that's correct. Just needs a paragraph B.
Good point. Further discussion to the A33. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A33 is adopted. Representative Frazier, opening remarks on the bill.
Yeah, and just quickly, Ms. James, thank you for that walkthrough, putting you on the spot there. I appreciate it. You did a great job. I just want to say the reason I thought that walkthrough was important because this bill, this conversation around this bill has been going on for well over or almost a decade now. And what I think this amendment shows is the constant ability to continue to have conversations around this to make this the best bill possible. Many of the changes in this, that this amendment address were concerns that we're hearing most recently, and we're trying to make the make sure we have the best bill possible when we get to the finality of this and get this in place for Minnesota. And so thank you for that and indulging me, members. Mr. Chair, House File 2 as amended would establish a state-paid family and medical leave program. No matter who you are, where you work, where you live, what you look like, or who you love, working people's need for family and medical leave is universal. Unfortunately, in Minnesota, only an estimated 13% of workers have access to paid family leave through their employer to care for a new child or a seriously ill family member. Less than half of Minnesotans have access to personal medical leave. According to data from the Pew Research Center, the U.S. is the only country among the 41 nations that make up the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in the European Union that doesn't have national paid leave policy. What we have nationally and here in Minnesota is an uneven safety net with significant gaps that means most Minnesota families are falling between those cracks. The research is clear. Access to paid leave contributes to healthy development of our little ones and improves outcomes for older adults who need care. It improves maternal health, reduces reliance on taxpayer-funded safety net programs, and enhances economic security. And make no mistake, there are significant costs we as a state and nation are bearing without access to paid family leave, including being home to the worst disparities in maternal and infant health among high economic countries, with full knowledge that the vast majority of those deaths are preventable. Comprehensive paid family and medical leave not only recognizes the humanity of people and improves a myriad of health outcomes, it also keeps people in the labor force, boosting our local economy and the entire U.S. economy. All workers experience illness or a family member's illness at some point in their lives. Access to paid leave should not be dictated by your gender, the color of your skin, your zip code, whether you work for a large or small employer, nor should it be denied to you because of your job title. We need to abandon the harmful narrative that only some people are worthy of or deserve to have their humanity recognized. Our current uneven system is leaving the most vulnerable Minnesotans behind. We have a cruel irony in our state. Those with higher incomes and with the ability to navigate a leave are, in fact, the people most likely to have access to a paid leave program. Access to paid leave is the lowest among workers with the greatest needs, and who is currently being left behind. Younger workers are being left out. Women are being left out. Black, indigenous, and other communities of color are being left out. No one should have to choose between a paycheck or caring for themselves and their family. And when faced with that choice, all too often, people are opting out of the workforce. In fact, research confirms caregiving responsibilities are a significant driver of exit from the labor force. Research consistently shows across race, gender, economic status, age, political affiliation, there is support for a comprehensive paid family and medical leave program. For example, nationally, 70% of small business support a publicly administered paid leave program. Paid leave programs are incredibly popular across party lines as well. 84% of voters support paid leave programs. And lastly, research also shows the cost of inaction on paid leave programs is over $22 billion of lost wages annually. To be clear, there is a moral, health, and safety and economic imperative for our state to act and to implement a paid leave program. With that, I would like to yield my time to testifiers for the rest of the remaining time.
Okay. It looks like first we have Dr. Sarah Lawrence. Dr. Lawrence, welcome to the committee. Oh, maybe not. Oh. We have. I'm sorry. If you could just state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony, and then we'll move to public testimony.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I'm the Director of Policy and Research at Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Representative Frazier asked me to do a brief overview of the structure of the program for the committee, if that's okay.
That's okay.
All right, great. In my prior role at the University of Minnesota, I led the research team that conducted Minnesota's legislatively mandated design and implementation study under contract with DEED. So as I said, I'll spend just a few minutes grounding the committee in a high-level overview of how the program would work. So House File 2 sets up a statewide publicly administered insurance program that is self-funded and sustainable over the long term through contributions from workers and employers. It allows self-employed people and business owners to join the program and employers to provide a comparable program. Eligibility is based on workforce participation and healthcare providers certify both the need for and length of most leaves. Much of the program is designed to build on Minnesota's successful UI processes, as well as the infrastructure developed and lessons learned in multiple U.S. states. Among design options, this one was chosen for a variety of reasons. I'll lift up three. First of all, it is a portable wage replacement benefit, which is especially important for workers with multiple employers or those changing jobs. Second, it creates the broadest possible risk pool, a feature necessary for keeping costs low and leveling the playing field among employers. And finally, it is the proven, effective, sustainable model that gives all workers an opportunity to earn and count on the benefit from year to year and makes costs currently borne by both employers and workers more predictable. While the bill provides up to 12 weeks, oops, sorry about that. There we go. Okay, sorry. While the bill provides up to 12 weeks for medical and 12 weeks for family leave for serious life events lasting more than 7 days, experience from multiple states as well as decades of U.S. Department of Labor surveys of employers and workers shows that workers take what they need, and that is on average less than the maximum allowed, even when fully paid and employment protected. For example, in Washington, the entitlement is 12 to 18 weeks, and the average has been around 7. There is no evidence that Minnesota workers are less committed to their employers or coworkers or more inclined to abuse their benefits than those in other states. In fact, one could argue the opposite. So House File 2 includes two related components, wage replacement and employment protections, with slightly different eligibility requirements. Wage replacement requires an earning history and an eligible event. Employment protections, or the right to return to your job, require wage replacement eligibility plus 90 days with the employer from which leave is being taken. House File 2 leave entitlements run concurrently with those under Minnesota's unpaid pregnancy and parenting leave law, as well as the federal FMLA. Now, the design of House File 2 sits squarely within the parameters of other states, with not a single major policy element that isn't matched or exceeded by other state programs. For example, five other states have combined leave entitlements that exceed those in House File 2. Five states also have a similarly expansive family definition. So with that, I will stop and be available for questions later.
Okay. And before we get to questions, I think we'll do public testimony now. And we have a number of people who signed up for public testimony. So we'll ask them to come down two at a time. I think maybe Representative Frazier, if you want to come to the members table for the moment. So we'll ask people to come down two at a time. And we'll ask people to limit their testimony to 2 minutes. I'll remind people if they go over 2 minutes. So first we'll have Dr. Sarah Lawrence, followed by Abby Loesch. And Dr. Lawrence, if you could just state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
All right, thank you. My name is Dr. Sarah Lawrence. I'm an internal medicine resident physician in Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you to the committee for having me today. As a physician, a mother, and a daughter, I have been deeply troubled and frustrated both personally and professionally by inadequate time away to address medically necessary issues through paid family and medical leave. 5 years ago, my mother was diagnosed with an aggressive cancer, and her health declined rapidly. As a sole earner for my family, I was unable to provide the care she needed without compromising my family's financial stability. Fast forward to my daughter's sixth birthday. The pandemic and the demands of my medical training led to progressive depression in this previously joyful little girl. She became withdrawn and repeatedly expressed a desire to end her life. I took 2 months of unpaid leave to care for my daughter when she needed it most, but additional medical costs piled up, and we were unable to afford those costs. As a doctor, I know well that nothing is more important than the health of individuals and their families. We all encounter circumstances where addressing these basic human needs requires paid time away, and 12 weeks of medical leave and 12 weeks of leave to care for an unwell child, spouse, or other loved one is simply non-negotiable. It's frankly embarrassing that the United States lags so far behind so many other countries in providing this basic need. Furthermore, a robust policy should also empower multiple people within a family to serve as caregivers. This is crucial for families trying to juggle around-the-clock care, as many of my patients' families struggle to do when illnesses occur or at the end of life. I envision Minnesota to be a state where families will be supported throughout life. I encourage you to help make this vision possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Abby Loesch, followed by Miera Allen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Abby Loesch, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership, which represents many of Minnesota's largest employers. First and foremost, members of the Minnesota Business Partnership support paid leave policies because it is the right thing to do for employees and for their families. In today's ultra-competitive workforce, providing paid leave is essential for attracting top talent to our state to live, work, and raise a family. Our member companies already offer the most generous paid leave benefits in the country. However, these businesses would not qualify to offer a private plan, even if their paid leave benefit program exceeded the minimum requirements currently outlined in the bill. They wouldn't qualify because of the expansive definition of family, no cap on the 24 plus weeks of leave, and the unpredictability of intermittent leave. We are concerned that the paid family medical leave proposal as written will unfairly impact our employees. It would disrupt their existing benefits and force them into a state-run program that would reduce their benefits while facing the added burden of a payroll tax. Paid family and medical leave should be a benefit to the employee. Imagine you're a pregnant woman who previously had paid leave benefits through your workplace, now having to contact a government-run state agency to access and be approved for your maternity leave benefits. Instead of being able to work with trusted colleagues in the HR department at your workplace, only to receive less of a leave benefit than your company previously offered to you. We respectfully ask the committee to ensure that a benefit program like paid leave not punish employees who already receive benefits at their companies. We have employers who have implemented paid leave benefits in other states. They know what works and what doesn't work. They are a wealth of knowledge and should be consulted to help construct a plan that works. We are prepared to work with you to find a path that helps expand paid leave to employees who don't currently have access to these benefits, but at the same time, not reducing paid leave benefits to the many employees who do receive them. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Miera Allen, who will be followed by John Reynolds. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Miera Allen. I'm a mother of six children, one who is 2 months old as of yesterday. I'm a resident and co-owner of Universal Cuts Barbershop in Brooklyn Center and a volunteer leader with the Barbershop and Black Congregation Corporation of Isaiah. I also service children and elderly adults in my community and have done so for the past 6 years. I am in 100% support of paid family medical leave. As a mother of six children, all under the age of 10 years old, it gets difficult to continuously provide the appropriate amount of attention to my children while caring for a newborn child. My husband is a self-contractor with no paid vacation time or sick pay. He has to work long hours to provide for us and is only available to either transport our children and in the morning time or see them to bed. It is a constant struggle for my husband to find quality time to bond with our newborn. I love my kids with every inch of my heart, but from time to time, I need a break to care for my own mental and emotional health as I'm recovering from my pregnancy. I can't hold the responsibility all by myself. My husband wants to be there, and he deserves to be there for the new baby and for us. When we can't take time off work to simply be there for our newborn, it becomes stressful and leads to things like depression and anxiety, and even causes tension in the household. As for myself, I also had to leave my newborn after 2 weeks of her being born to get back to work, which has caused me to feel guilty at times, and is extremely painful to not have the paid time to allow the opportunity to bond with my baby. I believe that small business owners and self-contractors should have the option to benefit from the state-run paid family medical leave program. Everybody deserves to take care of not only family, but themselves without worrying how they're going to survive financially throughout their time of medical and family obligations. I want to thank this committee for the time allowed to share my story about a bill that will be critical to the preservation of families and small business. And I would like to show you all a picture of my beautiful family.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Thanks for coming today, and thank you most of all for sharing the picture. Next, we'll have John Reynolds, who will be followed by Porvi Bhatt.
Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I don't have as nice looking family, so I won't show any family photos. Don't tell my wife I said that.
Danger.
I'm the state director for the National Federation of Independent Business in Minnesota. We represent 10,000 small businesses across the state, and our average member employs 10 Minnesotans, so generally talking very small businesses. Our members oppose House File 2 because of the cost, the burden, and the complexity that it imposes on small businesses. First, compared to the seven states with the most similarly structured programs, this bill would provide one of the longest leave lengths and one of the highest wage replacement formulas. And so we believe if program utilization looks more like Washington or Massachusetts compared to what's estimated in the fiscal note, that the cost of the program will grow significantly and the payroll tax will need to be much higher than 0.7%. Second, parts of the program are based on Minnesota's unemployment insurance program and the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act. It's important to note that employers with fewer than 50 employees are not subject to the federal FMLA, and therefore there would be a steep learning and compliance curve for them. But the parts that are based on FMLA and UI omit key provisions that balance the interests of employers and employees, and you can see this in the lack of clear ability for an employer to participate in the eligibility process and appeal an eligibility determination. You can also see this in how intermittent leave can be used under the bill, as well as the job reinstatement provisions. And lastly, third, the bill also omits key provisions in UI and FMLA that that prevent fraud in the program. You can see this partially in the inability or lack of clarity in the employer's ability to participate in the eligibility determination process, which is a key first step fraud prevention measure in UI, as well as FMLA's exclusion from job protection rights for those who obtain benefits fraudulently. So I hope that the committee will consider that one-size-fits-all approach just doesn't work for every small business in the state, and we look forward to working with you to try to improve the bill as it goes forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Porvi Bhatt, who will be followed by Paula Soderberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, committee. I'll be presenting a very different perspective, which is one from an immigrant family. My name is Porvi Bhatt, and I'm from Plymouth, Minnesota, and I was actually raised in Minnesota. I'm here to share my experience as a family caregiver, as an only child, as a second-generation Indian-American immigrant who cared for her aging parents until they died. This testimony is actually dedicated to my parents, Harshad and Rekha Bhatt, proud Minnesotans and first-generation Indian-Americans who came to this country in the early 1960s, pre-Civil Rights and pre-Immigration Act. Based on our family history, as well as my experience as a family caregiver and as a leader in healthcare, as a healthcare executive, I urge you today to pass the family, the Paid Family and Medical Leave Act. My 25-year caregiving journey began in 1998 when my father was suddenly diagnosed with early-onset dementia. Today, it's the dementia that we know Bruce Willis has. He was 58 and I was 28. As his illness progressed, the level of care he needed required both my mother and myself to take different times of leave to be able to support them. A few years later, our situation escalated when my mother's cancer reemerged and her cardiac and lung conditions worsened. Before I knew it, I became my parents' caregivers and they became my dependents. I had to reorganize all of my career priorities and face our family reality in a new day. Years later, after my father died, my mom and I lived together until she passed away last year. I worked remotely over 2 years, struggling to care for my mom, sheltered in place due to the pandemic, like many of us did. Finding vaccinated, masked, and paid home health workers to help me was difficult. I finally had no choice but to take a long-term leave of absence. These decisions to prioritize care at home come with significant trade-offs. With no siblings or partner, I struggle, and still do, to protect my own income, health insurance, and retirement savings. I cobbled together limited time and flexibility to keep my career afloat while translating doctor's calls, navigating business travel, clearing up family confusion, and making critical financial decisions. For years, I managed our situation across cultures, languages, and a Rubik's Cube of benefit plans and time-off policies. Early in my career, I faced a great deal of pressure to prioritize work over family. I would have to remind my employers that FMLA was here to protect me. Later, as I grew in my career, I received much greater support from companies who knew caregiving was part of my story. And I know this flexibility is not offered to many of us. It's only 13% of us that do. And that's why I'm here to testify today. I'm sure there's a version of my story that's happening even in your own family, if you take a moment and pause. Each of us knows the selfless mother, the selfless daughter, sister, niece, or cousin who made a sacrifice to care for her loved one. I focus on her. I'm here to remind us that she does so at a cost. Women, particularly women of color, assume family care responsibilities so quickly and so often without support. When we step into care, we step out of the workforce without pay and deliver care without reimbursement. Someone else gets that reimbursement. Family caregivers are the backbone of our care system, a system that cannot continue to rest on each family figuring it out on their own. Minnesota leads the way, and proudly so, with world-class health systems, incredible global companies, and the largest healthcare payers around the world. It's crucial we join the world now and provide paid family and medical leave. I urge you to pass this bill and honor our diverse tapestry of Minnesotans who care for their loved ones who are counting on you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony and for sharing your story with the committee. Next, we have Paula Soderberg, who will be followed by Gail Julius. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Paula Soderberg. I am the Vice President of Human Resources for Morrissey Hospitality. We own and operate 26 different restaurants, hotels, and venues throughout Minnesota. St. Paul Hotel, St. Paul Grill, Bunker Hills Event Center, Water Street, Freight House, all in Stillwater. At Morrissey, we take pride in building authentic relationships with all of our over 900 employees. When we emerged from the pandemic, we made sure that we were providing the best benefits and flexibility that we could to all of our employees. Recently, we implemented an unlimited paid time off pilot program so that our employees can take their rest and time away from work that they need with their families and still make their same income. Unfortunately, as drafted, HF2 would put a significant strain on our operations and our employees. Our businesses have learned to operate under FMLA standards, but this bill is quite a bit more complex and expansive than FMLA. First of all, employee eligibility should really be the same as FMLA's 1 year and 1,250 hours worked requirement. Any early eligibility date or hours requirement impacts all of the employees, not just the new ones, but the existing ones, as many people are still learning the skills required for their roles and to be integrated into their teams. To have them be removed from the team before a one-year date currently in place with FMLA poses challenges for many teams to function, as well as to an employer to find replacements in a hospitality industry where we already have an extraordinarily tight labor market. Secondly, I'm not sure if it's a 20 or 24-week total eligibility right now for the benefits, but that really is not workable for any company because it will put a significant operational burden on teams at locations. Third, the list of eligible family members is extremely expansive and it is not aligned with current FMLA laws. This again will cause confusion and it should be reevaluated to more closely match federal law. Finally, it is important to note that the premium cost is so expensive to employers that most employers will share it with their employees. And that concerns me as I believe that will have the opposite effect on employee morale and retention than what is truly being intended by this legislation. So today I ask that you consider the impact that this bill will have on both the employers and on that employee experience. And truly take into consideration the employee eligibility, aligning the weeks of leave and family definitions to match FMLA. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Gail Julius, who will be followed by Stephanie Shimp. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much for allowing me to come and speak today. My name is Gail Julius. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm an organizer and a voter and activist in Rochester, and I've come to tell you a little bit about my personal story today. So in November of 2019, I was diagnosed with a rare and terminal lymphoma. A week later, my wife took a day off of work to join me at the oncologist's office. It was going to be brutal for a bit, the doctors had said. We'll start with total body radiation and then follow up with chemotherapy. I still am on chemotherapy every week, once a week. I heard my wife, Tamara, ask, is she going to need someone with her for a while? The doctors responded with, it would be best if at least for the next month or two. Tamara took FMLA and was with me for all of my appointments. I might add that Tamara had only been working at her position for 6 months. Sometimes she worked from home, sometimes she couldn't, and family and friends would take over the responsibility of being with me. The FMLA that she took was unpaid. Medical bills stacked up, and we were seriously worried about how we would continue this financial process. I was asking at doctor's appointments, how much will this all cost? Will it be covered by insurance? No one should have to worry about finances during this kind of time, but as Tamara wasn't getting paid, that was all we were, and I wasn't getting paid, that was all we were thinking about. However, we lost a lot when Tamara and I didn't have the FMLA paid. I lost my place. That's why I support paid family medical leave for up to 12 weeks of medical and 12 weeks of family leave. I support the broad family definition as well so that there are not unnecessary exclusions for those who can provide that care. At the end of the day, when you're up against a big diagnosis like cancer or other urgent needs for care for yourself, your loved ones, you shouldn't have to worry about losing a paycheck, how to keep the refrigerator full while you're caring for your loved one. Please support the paid family medical leave.
thank you for your testimony and for sharing your story with the committee. Next is Stephanie Shimp, who will be followed by Duncan Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Stephanie Shimp, and I'm the owner of Blue Plate Restaurant Company. 30 years ago, I took a chance and left my serving job to open a restaurant that some of you may know, the Highland Grill. Today, Blue Plate has 7 small neighborhood restaurants like the Freehouse and Longfellow Grill, plus the Blue Barn at the Minnesota State Fair. We built Blue Plate with simple economics, a genuine passion for great food and hospitality, and meaningful connections with our guests. At the core of that is our commitment to our employees. Due to our roots as servers, my business partner and I are continually seeking ways to build a strong and sustainable culture. We offer a career path, we have comprehensive benefits such as health care for each employee, and a 401k with a 6% company match, and so much more. As written, House File 2 jeopardizes the foundation we built our restaurants on. This legislation does not account for the compounding impacts of inflation, which is impacting our food costs, and the other policies under consideration at the legislature, such as the 1% metro area sales tax, or the 75-cent retail delivery fee, or the cost of earned sick and safe time. We are still focused on recovery from the pandemic, and this policy, as compounded by others, will put that recovery at risk. One additional thing that keeps me up at night is the implementation and administration process. I grew up in Lake City, Minnesota, and I wonder how the mom-and-pop restaurant with 10 employees will be able to manage and account for this impact to their family restaurant. How will you find a replacement worker in greater Minnesota? And as for seasonal workers, each year I have students or teachers who join us as part-time for the summer, or more importantly, for the state fair. We bring on 120-plus employees for 12 days. Should we be paying a premium for leave for part-time or temporary worker? As written, this doesn't work for us. Please carefully consider the impact this legislation will have on our businesses for employees and employers alike. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Duncan Roper, who will be followed by Lauren Schaffhorst. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. My name is Duncan Roper, and I'm 16. This testimony is dedicated to my father. When I was 9 years old, my father was diagnosed with cancer. It was the single worst time of my life. The short amount of childhood I had left was ripped from me, and I was left to deal with the fallout almost entirely by myself. Instead of being with friends, I was Googling cancer survival rates, and instead of worrying about my homework, I was worried if the cancer was spreading. It was lonely, and as someone with anxiety, absolutely terrifying. Both of my parents worked full-time. Unlike some of the ladies and gentlemen who testified against this bill, they were not lucky enough to have paid family and medical leave. So my father worked through chemotherapy and was thus rendered incapable of helping around the house. So my mom picked up the slack. During the year where we battled with cancer, my mom did it all. Even with help from family and friends, she would still go to work for 10 hours, come back to take care of my dad and my 6-year-old brother, make any appointments for school or for us, and deal with any BS from hospitals or insurance. She was amazing, but she was also at a breaking point. My mother shouldn't have had to work herself to death, and my father shouldn't have had to work through chemotherapy. I shouldn't have had to look after myself at the age of 10. I'm still in therapy for it. I cannot stand the thought of another family being ruined by my situation. So I ask that you vote for the current paid family and medical leave bill. It allows for 12 weeks of medical and 12 weeks of family leave and ensures that multiple people can receive paid leave to give care to someone when it's needed. And this policy won't leave anyone behind either. I want our state to change for the better, and that is why I beg you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for sharing your story with me today. Appreciate it. Next is Lauren Schaffhorst, and followed by Sarah Piepenberg. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schaffhorst with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I am testifying in opposition to House File 2 on behalf of an organization where over 80% of our members offer paid leave in some form already, but not as specifically dictated by this bill. And that is why our members are telling us that House File 2 doesn't work for them, especially our small members who do not need or want this mandate to compete. It is too expensive, expansive, and its government-defined design is actually disruptive and punitive. The bill creates a mechanism for an employee to be away from their job for up to 24 weeks each year, a considerable new standard. Not every employee will take off the entire time, but despite what you've heard, experience shows that more time will be taken, and the bill as drafted almost guarantees it. When combined with the definition of family member, the expanded list of qualifying events, the enhanced wage replacement rate, and the stackability of the leaves. In combination with the up to 80 hours of mandated sick time the House passed earlier this session, Minnesota will be an outlier, and our members are rightfully concerned. We also have a critical and growing workforce shortage. In certain workplaces, such as hospitals or manufacturing that run 24/7, or in daycares, schools, or nursing homes where staffing ratios are carefully calibrated, we already do not have enough workers to fill in. Alarmingly, the states that have enacted paid leave programs are among those with the largest net domestic migration losses last year. Having such a specific and extended leave mandate will not only exacerbate workforce problems, it will disrupt existing benefits packages that hundreds of thousands of Minnesota workers currently enjoy. We are also highly critical of the state imposing a new payroll tax on every employer to create a broad new state-run insurance program that will collectively cost the Minnesota business community nearly $1.5 billion annually should the payroll tax rate hold. But that is unlikely given review of the fiscal note. Without modifications to the initial scope and design, we expect the program to run into solvency issues necessitating higher tax rate on employers and their employees. Increased costs further limit resources available for employee compensation, job growth, and expansion in Minnesota. In its current form, House File 2 would impede Minnesota's competitiveness and economic growth. There are other, more targeted and sustainable solutions that the legislature should consider instead. We appreciate the opportunity to share our opposition with the committee, and would just like to point to your packets that we have submitted a letter from the United for Jobs Coalition, which represents nearly 80 statewide organizations and local chambers and their hundreds of thousands of employees in opposition to House File 2 as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Sarah Piepenberg, who will be followed by Corey Anderson. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Sarah Piepenberg, and I am the owner, co-owner of Vinaigrette, a family-owned food store located in southwest Minneapolis, and I'm a member of Main Street Alliance. 4 years ago, one of our most valued long-term employees, Linda, fell and broke both of her arms. She was unable to work. If she went without her paycheck from us while she was out recovering, she was going to have to choose between putting food on the table and making rent. But I've told this story many times, right here, in fact. We paid her while she was out because it was the right thing to do. Paying her saved me money in having to hire and train a new employee, but caused us to be late on our commercial rent and our house payment. It was a real struggle. My story continued with Linda as she went on to be diagnosed with ALS and died May 4th in 2021. I've looked into plans available on the private market, and the best option would cost 50% more than this proposal, offer only 6 weeks off, excludes coverage for cancer, and requires a health screening. In other words, the private market provides unaffordable substandard options. When it's illegal in Minnesota to separate a cat from her kittens or a puppy from its mother before 8 weeks of age, why are we separating mothers and babies at 6 weeks? We have a child care crisis in Minnesota. This paid leave policy would lift the burden for the first 3 months, potentially 6 months, that care centers are currently facing. This shouldn't be a struggle for any of us. The Universal Paid Family Medical Leave Program creates a system where everyone pays in a little and everyone benefits. A recent survey of 600 small businesses found that overwhelming support for public paid leave policies. Another survey also showed that, like me, the vast majority of small business owners, 84%, are not able to provide paid leave on their own, and a said social insurance program would help them offer paid leave to their employees, helping them attract and retain dedicated employees like Linda, and avoiding the cost involved in replacing employees who have to take extended time off to grow a family or give care or recover. Small business owners and our employees alike need a paid family medical leave program like the one in this bill. I urge the committee to advance House File 2.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Corey Anderson and then Mary Jo Meleka.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Corey Anderson. I'm here representing NAFA and MAHU, two organizations with many members in each legislative district and more than 1,000 members statewide. I'm the owner and founder of Disability Geek Insurance Agency, specializing in disability insurance, and I've been in the business over 20 years, and I have 4 employees. Through the years, we have worked with over 1,200 clients protecting the income of business owners and their employees, both hourly and salaried. I, along with the members of MAHU and NAFA, are opposed to Senate File 2 and House File 2 in its current form. Legislators need to understand that medical leave in this bill is the same as their short-term disability coverage. As a specialist in this area, I can tell you that the private sector has affordable short-term disability products available with very broad coverage for just about every group and individual. With many providers offering coverage for disability income, the market is competitive, so the prices are very affordable. Most employers already offer either subsidized short-term disability coverage to their employees or voluntarily unsubsidized coverage, where the employee has the option to purchase group coverage. To the extent that the employee has not opted for coverage, they are making a value decision on what works best for their personal needs. Since the advocates of the bill claim to have run into problems finding coverage, they may need to talk to another agent that has more expertise in these lines of business. My cards are right here. The perception of a scarcity is not an accurate representation of our marketplace today. What this bill does is put the state government in direct competition with the private sector. The bill is a virtual market takeover by a state agency with no experience delivering this service or accurately pricing such a product. For instance, the current tax rate in the bill is lower than that of similar programs in other states whose coverage is much narrower. This points to high likelihood of large tax increases to fund the benefits promised. Legislators have also not considered the loss of tax revenue when private sector jobs are displaced, which includes loss of corporate income tax, personal income tax, and premium taxes. We recommend the following if you move the bill forward. One, let the private sector serve the market for short-term disability or medical leave. Mandate employers with over 50 employees offer short-term disability coverage and provide financial incentives for employers with 50 or fewer employees to provide that coverage to their employees. Outline more flexible minimum coverage requirements under which private plans would qualify under the mandate. Two, focus the bill on providing a family leave program since there is not currently a well-developed private market. Recognize the employee shortages and the differences between large employers and small employers, those with 50 or fewer employees, ability to handle longer absences of key employees. With our approach on the medical leave issue, Minnesotans can enjoy the benefits of this legislation by January 1st, 2024, rather than waiting till July of 2025. Our clients and the public are not interested in another unfunded mandate that creates a billion-dollar payroll tax on businesses and their employees. The public likes the idea of coverage. They don't like the idea of another tax shrinking their paycheck in a time of high inflation with the economy moving towards a recession. Please vote no. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. And then our last public testifier is Mary Jo Maleka. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Mary Jo Maleka. I reside in New Brighton, and I'm a leader with Isaiah. My first child was born 38 years ago. I had been living with type 1 diabetes for 12 years, so it was a high-risk pregnancy. After experiencing preterm labor and blood pressure spikes, my doctor decided it was safest to deliver my son early via cesarean at 37 weeks. We were both doing well, and my doctor said I could return to work 8 weeks after the surgery. Sadly, my employers, when informed of this great news, told me that I needed to be back at work 5 weeks postpartum because I had, in essence, started my allotted 6-week unpaid maternity leave when I left the company to be on bed rest. I told them that my doctor advised against returning to work 5 weeks after major surgery. They refused to extend my maternity leave to 8 weeks. Even though the financial ramifications for my young family were severe, I decided to follow my doctor's orders, and I did not return after 5 weeks. I was fired. I never would have believed that what happened to me 38 years ago would still be happening to women today. Unfortunately, it still is. Women in Minnesota are being told they need to get back to work just weeks after giving birth, or they will lose their jobs. I have been testifying in favor of paid family and medical leave since 2016. It's an important law to pass. It's an important benefit workers should have because it will, if it hasn't already, touch nearly everyone in some way. I simply don't understand how some legislators aren't doing more to connect the dots between workforce shortages and how this bill will actually help with worker retention. My husband and I are retired now, so PFML doesn't apply directly to us, but I want our sons and our daughters-in-law to have this benefit. I want them to have paid leave when they or their children need it. And selfishly, I want them to have paid leave available if or when we need care. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. All right, that concludes public testimony. We'll move now to amendments. So I'll invite Representative Frazier to return to the testifiers table. I believe we have two. We have the A32, which I have from Representative O'Driscoll, I believe. Would you like to move the A32 amendment, Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A32 amendment to the bill as adopted, please. Or as amended, excuse me.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the A32 amendment to the amendment, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things is we've been looking at this bill and looking to tighten it up a bit to make sure that there isn't some gaps in here or people who might want to try to game the system. I've looked and there's nothing in the language that says that I couldn't take leave from one position and start in another position or start in another company or start an at-home business if I'm working on leave from another employer. So to prevent people from kind of job hopping, if you will, or playing some gamesmanship, the A32 amendment just says that during the time of your disability, you would leave, you would not be working at other employment or taking on new employment during that time as well. You'd be getting a paycheck and disability from one of your employers as a result of this. And so I'm pretty sure that that's an oversight by the bill author, and something of this nature is probably going to be needed and warranted in the bill, or it's going to just cause skyrocketing premiums and payroll taxes to employers if we don't take care of this. And again, those who would be putting those and sharing cost sharing with their employees on that. So I encourage a yes vote on the A32 amendment to tighten up that provision and language.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Driscoll, you know, the idea of this bill is designed for individuals that need to take leave. I mean, it's almost as a last resort that they have to take these leaves. I can give an example of a situation, and I'm not sure if this is what you're trying to touch on, but there could be an example where an individual needs to take leave from a physically demanding job, but then they are able to work at a job that is less physically demanding. In a situation like that, there would be some prorating of the fees. What I want to make sure that we don't do is put folks in a situation where they have to totally leave the workforce. We've heard compelling testimony here. We've heard compelling testimony throughout every committee that this bill has touched. And I want to make sure that we're not excluding individuals. The bill was drafted intentionally to ensure that we were encapsulating as many Minnesotans and many workers as possible to provide this benefit. So I'm going to be asking for a no vote on this, but particularly we're obviously still open to having conversations down the line. There are a couple of more committee stops. So your concern, I'm willing to have more conversation about it, but I will be asking for a no vote today.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the co-author's comments this afternoon, I did hear him say that the bill was actually written so that you could take leave and go and get another job, maybe an at-home job or become an independent contractor. And that's unfortunate. So I would like to make sure that we maybe have a roll call on this then as well.
Representative Driscoll requests a roll call. There will be a roll call. Any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll. The chair votes no.
Stevenson, no. Vice Chair Cotizza-Wattoon?
No.
Cotizza-Wattoon, no. Representative O'Driscoll?
Yes.
O'Driscoll, aye. Representative Bierman?
Bierman, no.
Bierman, no. Representative Dotseth?
Dotseth, aye.
Dotseth, aye. Representative Freiberg?
No.
Freiberg, no. Representative Cleavorn is not here. Excused. Representative Cagle?
No.
Cagle, no. Representative Kraft?
No.
Kraft, no. Representative Liebling?
No.
Liebling, no. Representative New Brindley?
Yes.
New Brindley, yes. Representative Niska?
Yes.
Niska, yes. Representative Perryman?
Aye.
Perryman, yes. Representative Farr?
Yes.
Farr, yes. Representative Tapke?
No.
Tapke, no.
6-2. There being 6 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. There is also the A36, which I also have from Representative O'Driscoll. Would you like to move the A36?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A36 amendment to the bill as amended earlier in committee.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the A36. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As has been mentioned in some of the testimony, there are a number of bills that have been moving this session. paid family medical leave, safe and sick time. Some bills we have heard about accommodations for first-year moms in the workplace, and we also have Secure Choice, which is another mandate on employers to offer a program that would allow them to invest for their future. In some of these programs, we've amended the language, and in other bills, members of the majority party have willingly offered amendments to change the number of people who are involved in here. As a matter of fact, there was a bill that dealt with meat packers, if I'm not mistaken, earlier, and it exempted a number of them from 100 or more. It would apply less than 100. It wouldn't apply. So we are used to exceptions in bringing groups out that might receive a hardship. What this amendment does is it says employers with 50 or more employees would be included, and those with less than 50 would be excluded from this mandate. And so that is the extent of the bill. And again, when you're looking at a situation where it's you as the employer and an individual, where there's two people, you may have to hire two more people to administer all four or five of the programs that I just talked about in your small business, and it really makes it difficult for a small business to be able to thrive and to do that. So, Mr. Chair, I ask for a yes vote on the A36 amendment.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Driscoll, I'm again going to be asking for a no vote. The theme here is excluding workers. The intention of this bill was to be inclusive of workers. What we have in this state and we have around this country is a large swath of workers that have been excluded from the ability to have these benefits. And when we see them go out, when they need to go out, they then become detached from the workforce. And that is a larger issue that we're trying to address to maintain and retain workers. So I'm going to be asking for a no vote here.
Representative Katiza Batum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Driscoll, I see your point in introducing this, and particularly with you know, the mention of some of the other bills that we have amended earlier on in this session to maybe make them a little bit more compatible for businesses of varying sizes. But I think that the fact that we've done that for some of the other proposals that have gone through makes this actually less tenable. Because, you know, if we said, all right, now employers who have less than 100 employees or less than 50 employees don't have to offer the same workforce protections for nursing nursing parents that in Representative Cagle's bill that we passed off the floor, or they don't have to qualify for the sick and safe time. This is the bar minimum in my opinion. I mean, so people have a baby, or they adopt a child, or their new foster family, or if they are so physically or emotionally challenged that they can't do their job, I think this is exactly why we shouldn't adopt this amendment, because we already have made some of these concessions in some of the other proposals. So I would ask our team to vote no.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate your comments, Representative Katiza Watun. And I think it just goes to show that this amendment is actually really necessary. The fact that these concessions have been made is because it is really important to our small businesses to continue to not just thrive but survive. We really need to understand that, particularly for our small businesses, this is going to be crushing. And you know, I mean, I did some math, and looking at the small business assistance grants, frankly, it's a lovely idea, but it doesn't come close to what the costs our small businesses are going to incur. I mean, we're talking a 0.7% payroll tax. We're talking increased property taxes, because they're going to have to pay this for their school districts. Additional increased property taxes, because they're going to have to pay this for their cities. Additional property tax, because they're going to have to pay this for their counties. And in addition to that, if they can even find a temporary employee, which is a huge if in this environment, they're going to have to pay a premium to have that employee there temporarily while they hold this job for 6 months. This is not about special circumstances for our small employers. This is not about helping them to thrive. This is about helping them to survive. We absolutely will lose small businesses in this state if we don't afford these protections. And I think the fact that we have provided those concessions in other bills is exactly evidence of the fact that they need those concessions. Otherwise, we wouldn't have made them. We need these concessions. This is a really good amendment. And I don't know if Representative O'Driscoll asked for a roll call, but I will.
Representative Brindley asked for a roll call. There will be a roll call. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for bringing this amendment. I think that it's important to keep in mind a couple of things as we're thinking about increased government regulation and increased cost on small business. And the first is that, you know, every time we make the legal compliance environment more complicated, it is a subsidy for all of the for the legal profession, first of all, for the human resources profession, but for every large business that can afford to buy legal services, HR services, et cetera, in bulk. And it is a huge drag on every startup company, every small business that's struggling to survive, everyone who's trying to start a business or trying to survive and provide jobs, provide services for their community. Complexity is a subsidy. So every time we try to make, we make the legal environment, the regulatory environment more complicated for small businesses, what we're doing is we're subsidizing the biggest businesses who can afford the lawyers, the accountants, the HR professionals in order to comply with the very, the onerous requirements that to just figure out how to make the system work. And then we're also placing into position very, very onerous reinstatement rights that just don't work for the smallest the smallest businesses in our state. The smallest businesses are not necessarily able to hold open a job for 24 weeks or for 12 weeks or even for 7 weeks and without hiring a replacement. And then when the worker comes back, those businesses are going to really, really struggle to survive. And so I think that it's really important that we put in the same kind of carve-outs that I think we reasonably have placed into some other bills. I think it's the federal FMLA has a reasonable threshold of 50. We've put similar thresholds in as well. And I think that the important through line of all of those is that when we make the regulatory environment too difficult for small businesses, then what we're doing is we're telling we're tipping the playing field in favor of Walmart, in favor of Target, in favor of all of the biggest companies that can afford to do the regulatory compliance, and we're making it harder for the mom and pop shops, the small businesses, the new startups, etc. And so I think it's really important that we make this fix. So thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for this amendment, and I urge members to support it.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a different perspective. And for 5 years, I ran a small organization in Minnesota, a nonprofit. I had two other full-time employees and a dozen or so part-time employees. And I had one of my full-time employees need about 2 months of leave. And as someone running a small organization, you're very close to your employees. There was no way that I could not let that person take that 2 months off. And I needed to keep compensating them because of their financial situation. So, you know, I ate it, and it almost put the organization out of business. I would have loved to have this kind of support backing me up at that time. So I think this is a values bill. This is about our values as a state. And I just see that this kind of thing, yes, I recognize that there are additional costs involved, but it's an insurance policy for situations like that. And I think it's absolutely worth it. And I would urge a no vote on the amendment.
Representative Perriman.
Thank you, Chair. My comments are briefly, like Representative Kraft said, and also then supportive around here. I am a small business owner. At one time, I had a business of 120 employees, and now I'm down to 20. And you cannot use a cookie-cutter approach for 120 employees and then someone down to 20. Our responsibilities are much different in those sizes. One size does not fit all. Right now, in the 3 years of COVID, small businesses struggled because of different things. And this is going to be another strain on them to absorb increased taxes. Property taxes will go up, as I said. I have to hold positions open for people to come back. I can't even get enough people to hire now, much less hold that position. And what it will do, too, it'll put lots of stress on my other employees, because we're all going to have to pitch in for the one or two people we're holding that position for. Is that fair to all those other employees? I don't think so. And the other thing is, splitting this tax with an employee, I won't do it, because that's who I am. I will absorb the whole thing, because as you said, Representative Kraft, our employees need what they need. We will do it, because we want to keep them, and we don't have to pay a premium bonus to hire at, you know, we'll give you a $1,000 signing bonus, because we are known to treat our employees very well, and we'll do what we have to do without government telling us what to do. And again, I will always say, the owner is always the last one to get paid. And I am proud to always make sure my employees are whole with their own families, with themselves, and I don't need someone else to tell me to do this, because it's really going to hurt organizations over under. We need the under 50, like Representative Jusko said, because those individual businesses can't absorb all the costs we just called out, and something will break. And you know what will break is the business industry and downtown, Main Street downtown, who have small employers, and they do not need these kind of mandates on them. Thank you.
Representative Dodson. I have to say, Representative Jusko, great amendment. This is the type of amendment that we need to be looking at. This is looking at the best interest of small businesses. I don't know if any of you have driven in Greater Minnesota recently. Greater Minnesota is dying. They're struggling just to stay alive. This is another nail in the coffin right now that's going to greatly affect these small businesses and keep them alive. Small businesses in Greater Minnesota, we realize that they're family members that are working for us. They're neighbors. They're friends. And you know what? They know what's best for their employees. But to limit and not allow, we're working on a shoestring right now just to stay alive. You know, Representative Kraft, you mentioned that you just about closed the doors. Yeah. But you know what? Small businesses struggle. And this is just another example where we put more pressure on the small businesses. I think this amendment by allowing 50 is very reasonable. I would ask that you would consider this. I think it's fair. I think it's reasonable. I think that if we look across the board what we've done in similar situations, it makes sense. I would ask that you consider this. So thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I guess everybody has something to say about this. Sorry. Looking at the amendment, it looks to me like it doesn't just give the smaller employers an option. It just removes them altogether. And I think we heard pretty clearly from some folks today that, and from Representative Kraft too, that this is something that a lot of small employers really want. And I originally raised my hand just to speak to the assumption that I'm hearing and that I have heard in some of my email, that if you don't allow somebody to take a leave or you don't pay them for the leave, that they won't take the leave anyway. And somehow the business is better off, that somehow the business won't have to deal with having an absent employee. And we know that just isn't true. We heard from some people here today. People are going to do what they have to do to take care of their families. And I think our task as legislators is to think about the greater good. How does this impact the state as a whole? How does this impact our people as a whole? I think this does help people to actually stay in the workforce. And one of the things I heard today from the testifiers that I thought was especially compelling was about being able to stay home and take care of your newborn when you can barely find a slot for childcare. Just think of the pressure that it takes off the childcare situation. Think of the financial savings for the family if you can just spend those few extra weeks with that newborn. Not even to mention the bonding I mean, this is the most family-friendly legislation that we can really even think about. I think that this policy is would do more than just about anything I've seen in this legislature to increase the health and well-being of Minnesotans. And so I strongly support the bill, and I strongly oppose the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing the bill forward. I've heard a lot about what people have said about small businesses, and the thing I will certainly agree on is it's not easy to run a small business. I've been involved in my family business. We're third generation. I've seen everything as far as why people need to take time off and how we as a small business who try to treat our employees like family, make sure that we can help them to the greatest extent possible. And in the last half dozen years, as this bill has been coming forth at the state legislature, I've been a big fan of this. As a small business owner, I have lost employees who come in, young employees who are good, talented individuals who I want to hire. I offer them a contract, and they're looking a little bit further down the road. They say, we're going to have kids. We need to have planning for time off to raise our, you know, have our child at home and have time, paid time off. And can you accommodate that to the extent that we need it? And, you know, we help out people who wish to do that, but what they want to do is they want to go find those businesses, the big businesses that already have it built in, and the playing field is tipped toward them now. So it's been challenging to keep and retain good people in our local community. Instead, they leave our local community, go to the big city, and we lose them. This would help retain people in your community. It just gives them an ability to take care of their families. As Chair Liebling mentioned, this is, I think, also one of the strongest family value bills we're seeing up here at the State House this year, and I'm hopeful that we can pass it. This COVID, somebody mentioned COVID and the struggles small businesses had during that time. You know, we struggled too. The UI platform was helpful. It was pretty functional and easy to use, and it helped us retain those employees. And so I look at it as a strong positive that we're going to be looking at the same type of platform for this program. Far less work for a business owner to keep track of, dealing with individual insurance companies on individual plans where the plans are different. So if we unify this and it has an application across the state for employees, I think about my kids who are going out and working for other companies, that they'll have access to this plan. So, you know, it's just far less complexity for a small business. And the other point I do make, and I do grant that, you know, when people leave your small business and you have to cover for them, it's difficult. Everybody has to step up a little. It's not always easy to find a replacement. But you can't say no when someone has to go for chemotherapy for weeks. You have to accommodate them. And this gives us as a business an ability to help them. And they're appreciative, and they come back to work as soon as they possibly can. So thanks again, Representative Frazier, for bringing the bill forward. I'm eager to vote yes, and I'll vote no on this amendment.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my colleagues covered the basis pretty well here. I just was also going to be recognized to make sure that we do remember that we have a roll call on this one.
We do have a roll call, and Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll. The chair votes no.
Stevenson, no. Vice Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
No.
Cotizza-Watoon, no. Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah.
O'Driscoll, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, no.
Bierman, no. Representative Dotseth.
Dotseth, yes.
Dotseth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
No.
Freiberg, no. Representative Kegel.
No.
Kegel, no. Representative Kraft.
No.
Kraft, no. Representative Liebling.
No.
Liebling, no. Representative New Brindley.
Yes.
New Brindley, aye. Representative Niska.
Yes.
Niska, aye. Representative Perryman.
Aye.
Perryman, aye. Representative Farr.
Aye.
Farr, aye. Representative Tapke.
No.
Tapke, no.
There are 6 ayes and 8 nays. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. There are no further amendments, so we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So appreciate the conversation, and I think Representative Crafty said, oh, this almost broke,
your small business when you had to do what you had to do for an employee. But the piece that I think we're failing to remember here is you're still paying for it. You and the employee are paying for this program. Somebody's got to pay for it. It's still going to break you. And so I think I'm very concerned with that, and the small businesses that I've heard from are very concerned with that. So to the bill's author, is there a payroll cap in this? I mean, we're estimating a 0.7% payroll tax, but do we have a cap in there? Can we ensure our employers that it won't be more than X?
When you say a cap, you mean on the premium?
On the cap premium.
On the premium?
Yes.
I think it's fixed, Representative Frazier.
It is fixed, but I'm going to – I do have some staff here from DEED that can probably go into more detail to make sure we're answering your question.
Oh, they can adjust it, yeah.
Right, right.
If you could just identify yourself for the record and proceed to your testimony here.
Evan Rowe, Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative, it's the premium limit is up to the FICA limit, which this year in calendar year 2023 is $160,200. It's adjusted annually by the federal government.
But it's...
Representative Farr.
I'm sorry. Thank you, okay. Mr. Chair. It, as I understand it, is 0.7% of the payroll dollars. This year.
And I'm sorry, I spaced on your name again.
Evan Rowe.
Rowe?
Yes.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, so it's, I guess, a couple things. One is the premium as contemplated in the legislation is maximum of is 0.7% in the initial year. Half of that can be charged back to the employee, as has been discussed. That is, of that premium, that premium can be charged against up to the first $160,200, or the FICA limit of an individual's income.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me rephrase the question then. Is there any cap? Can it go up to 1.4% the following year? Can it go to 2.1% the next year? Can it go to 3% the following year?
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, I believe the bill, and the author can correct me if I'm wrong, caps the total premium, and again, half can be charged back to the employee at a maximum of 1.2%.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frazier, I guess I did not see that in the bill. Is that the case? It's capped at 1.2%?
I believe that is accurate. Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Farr, I believe that is accurate.
Thank you.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, again, I've talked to several small businesses, or we've described them as mom and pops today. But I've talked to school districts who said that this could put them on the brink. I've talked to a school district who said with what's being proposed now, what's out there today, and this isn't done, but this will cost them 30%. This mandate will cost them 30% more than the increase that we're proposing to give them in funding. And so talk to the communities that have the same concern, and I talk to counties that have the same concern. And so this burden is going to come to either an employee or employer. And for those particular entities, those public entities, that burden is going to come back to us in taxes. This is going to be a very costly endeavor for our job creators, and I'm very concerned with that. And so I guess I would just urge a no vote today and take a look at refining this before we move forward.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple of questions. My first question would be, is Representative Frazier, do you know if there has been an analysis done on the cost to school districts, cities, counties? I know that kind of thing is not typically reflected in the fiscal note because that applies to the cost to the state, but I'm wondering if you know if an analysis has been done on that.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brindley, I am not aware if there has been an analysis done, but I will look to my I will look to staff to see if they are aware of that. I am not aware that one has been done at this
point. Mr. Rowe is standing up. Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Chair, that I don't want to deflect the question, but that might be a better question for the LBO. Our agency hasn't done a fiscal analysis on the local units of government, but that's certainly within the that might be in their purview.
Representative Brindley.
If something is available, it would be helpful if that was made available to members of the committee. That would be really helpful if we can find that out. My other question is, I did not find it in the language, but perhaps I missed it. I'm wondering if, you know, our UI program has an experience rating, right? So businesses who have employees that make use of this at a higher rate, they pay a higher experience rating, they end up paying a larger share of those premiums versus businesses who use it very little. And I didn't see it, but I'm wondering if there is an experience rating or something like that in this language.
Representative Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brindley, there is currently no experience rating in this language. And the reason being, we don't want to punish folks for using this benefit or having access to it.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate those responses. I just will make the comment. I am really concerned, even if we're talking about 1.2, every single state that has passed this has doubled their premium percentage on and so thinking that we're starting at 0.7%, I'm assuming that we will hit that 1.2% cap immediately. Again, we've heard that we don't know if there's been an analysis done on the cost to school districts, cities, or counties, but I know that all of those entities have shared significant concerns about the costs. And again, I would reiterate that those costs fall back on our small businesses, our employers. And, you know, it's not just the cost of the premium. The cost of the premium is already going to be difficult for a lot of these folks. However, we're talking cost of property tax increases for the school districts who are going to have to pay significantly more for all of their employees. These are huge employers in a lot of our districts. Talking about the cost to cities, the cost to counties, these are enormous costs that the cities and counties and school districts are going to have to come up with the money for that somewhere, and those things are paid through property taxes. It is going to increase property tax. This bill is a property tax increase across the state, and it's probably going to be a significant property tax increase. And again, our businesses get that double whammy, triple whammy on all three of those entities, plus the premium. And I would just add, you know, I asked the question about experience ratings, and I think in the UI program, the experience ratings are not there to punish folks. The experience ratings are not there to discourage folks from using it. The experience ratings are there to ensure a more fair and equitable system. They're there to ensure that businesses who have a high turnover, who have high unemployment costs, the employers are paying additional costs for that. And I think about this specific example, you know, my local Dairy Queen in town, they have really struggled since the pandemic. In fact, half the time, their dining room is still closed. They can't afford to keep it open because they can't get folks in the door to work. It is still really difficult. 90% of their employees are high school kids, three of whom are mine. But the vast majority of their employees are high school kids. And those high school kids, there's a very slim chance. And I understand that it's possible, and on rare occasion, those kids might take advantage of this program, right? There may be circumstances where they would need to. However, that's going to be a rare circumstance. That's not going to be the norm. That's not the target for this program. And yet, that employer is going to have to pay that experience rate, or excuse me, this premium for all of those employees who likely will never take advantage of this program, who is already paying, he's going to pay the higher property tax, he's going to pay the for schools, he's going to pay for cities, he's going to pay for counties, he's probably going to end up paying 1.2%. That 0.7% is almost surely not going to hold. It's not held in a single state that has passed this. And he's going to be paying this money, and it's not going to help him. And, you know, I tell you what, we just had a lengthy discussion about small businesses. So I will just say this. You know, making small businesses do something that they can't afford doesn't help them compete. It just puts them out of business. That's what we're doing to our small businesses with this.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brindley, I just want to respond to a couple of comments. I mean, the experience rating that you're referring to, I think the UI system is a little bit different here. I mean, employers can control whether or not they fire someone, and they get to go through the process of how they hire those individuals and maintain employees. What I don't want to see, what we don't want to see happen in this situation is an employer making a decision on whether or not to hire individuals because he's trying to, or they, she, are trying to determine whether or not this individual is going to have that, is going to take leave. For instance, I don't want discrimination. We don't want any situations where someone is going to be discriminated against and not hired because they are a woman that would be hired, and there may be consideration that they may become pregnant and need to access the leave. We're trying to avoid situations like that. So that's one of the reasons why we don't have an experience rating in this particular bill, because I think that's different than the way the UI system is set up. And also, I believe you mentioned earlier that the premiums would double, and they doubled in every other state. I'm not aware of that. I don't know if you want to cite something for that, but I would like to bring up a testifier to probably address what's happened in some of the other states.
All right, Ms. Patrick is up here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, Representative New Brindley, members of the committee. I think they're, you know, maybe referring to the Washington State experience, a program that was stood up in the middle of the pandemic. They made a conscious decision not to increase their rates during the pandemic. But all other states, that has not been the experience, where there's a doubling of the premiums. Washington or Massachusetts, in fact, reduced their premium in the last year. So I don't know that that's a fair assessment of the total landscape of state programs.
And Ms. Fitzpatrick, before you step down, did Washington State prime the program with an appropriation? I understand there's a significant appropriation in this bill. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. No, Washington State did not have the benefit of having a surplus situation where they were able to front load the program. I think that's going to have a significant impact on getting this program off to a solid start and reducing the need for increased premiums in the out years.
Thank you. Representative Dotson.
Thank you. Representative Frazier, could you maybe just explain a little bit what the mechanics of building this program will look like with the IT, the extensive cost to build this? I know that in past Minnesota may or may not have had the real good track record of past program building. Can you explain what that looks like and just kind of go over the mechanics? My understanding, this is a completely unique program to the state of Minnesota. It's not similar to other states. This is a kind of a standalone program, so we're not cloning another program or another state. So there's a lot of different mechanics involved here. Could you explain that, please?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a commissioner here to talk about the architect components of this.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think just a few general thoughts. One, I think our approach would be to be using as many off-the-shelf components as we possibly can, you know, learning the lessons of past projects, and I think and many successful projects. I think the UI example was previously provided. There are several other states that have implemented or are in the middle of implementing other programs. In addition to Washington State, Colorado, Oregon, Massachusetts, and District of Columbia, several others have existing paid family medical leave programs that are in many ways similar to ours. There are certainly unique elements to the ones that is contemplated in the bill here, but there are certainly lots of lessons learned, systems approaches that I think that we'd be able to learn from and hopefully reuse a lot of the work that other states have done. So I don't think it would be a totally de novo undertaking. We certainly have the benefit of our own UI program and the work of other states.
Representative Dotson.
With that, so thank you for your feedback there. The question would be is, I mean, we've got to have some accountability for our taxpayers. What assurance can we give our taxpayers that we're being good stewards of their money and that we're following protocol the best possible way we can here?
Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think first of all, that's something that we seek to do in every project that we undertake within the administration and just generally speaking. I think specifically there are, you know, a few ways that we can do that. One is, as I just said, try to use off, you know, as much off-the-shelf kind of standard functionality to the extent that we can find it, work with vendors who have done such builds, make sure that we are, working with using innovative procurement processes to make sure that we have the strongest contracts, getting the best price that we possibly can, and holding vendors accountable when we're using private sector vendors to ensure that we are getting full value for money. I won't say that that is simple, but it's something that we know how to do, and it's something that we're comfortable doing, and I think that can lead to a very good result.
One last follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, just one final question. What is the estimated cost of this project of startup,
Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Chair, Representative, looking in the exact details in the fiscal note, but I think the initial costs are estimated at being about $83 million. And that's generally in line with programs of this size and scale and complexity. When you think about the volume of benefits being paid, there are startup costs to make sure that we would be able to deliver good results. And then there's some ongoing maintenance as one needs to necessarily maintain a system once it's been implemented.
And I'll just note that the bill is traveling to the Workforce Committee next, specifically to address the issues in the fiscal note in terms of the cost to deed for these types of things.
Thank you.
Any final comments, Representative? Nope. Okay. Representative Katisa Watu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks again, Representative Frazier, for bringing the bill before the committee today and to Representative Richardson for carrying this bill over the last biennium. In just listening to public testimony today, I found it really interesting how everyone seems to support paid leave benefits. And we agree that Minnesotans should have access to some sort of benefit like this. But then we have industry coming to us, and then we have amendments that disallow employees of small businesses to support the very option and opportunity to have these benefits. It doesn't help small business owners. That doesn't help workers. It just doesn't make sense that we would try to do carve-outs like that because we agree. We agree. Minnesotans agree that people should have access to this kind of benefit. We also do need to consider the financial situation, the majority of households across the country right now, where 60% of U.S. households, including 40% of those with six-figure incomes, are currently living paycheck to paycheck. So I think, when we look at the amount of pay that this actually provides, it's not a full income replacement. It's an average of 66%, as I'm understanding the language in the bill. So to me, if my household is potentially living paycheck to paycheck, 66% average pay is not going to get me very far, such that I would want to falsify my reasons for taking this leave, such that I would try to defraud this program. This is designed so that people who need to use this time, that they have access to it, and they have a little bit of financial help so that they can then return to work once they've accessed this leave. I think also here in the Commerce Committee, we do have jurisdiction over a wide number of industries. And I think something that we should consider is the direct benefit to some of these industries and individuals as a whole. I was doing some outside research, and I was looking at different paid leave programs across the country. One of the things that I've seen is that PFML programs lead to increased vaccination rates. And then, kind of the ROI on immunizations, for every dollar, it's estimated that there are $44 in economic benefits returned to the community and to the nation. So if there was just a 2% increase in early childhood immunization based on a parent being able to take them to their doctor visits and get them those vaccinations, the estimated annual net benefit of that is valued at $196.4 million. That's big money. We have a huge problem in healthcare spending in this country. Infants are also more likely to attend their well baby checkups when they have somebody at home to bring them to the doctor. California's paid family leave policy was correlated with a reduction in prevalence of obesity, ADHD, and hearing problems. Obesity is estimated to be associated with nearly $4,000 of additional healthcare costs per individual in the United States of America. If we reduce the obesity rate in correlation with paid family medical leave by 1.6%, just 1.6%, that could yield $6.2 billion of savings in healthcare spending in the United States of America. These numbers are incredible. And I think that we really, we talk about the expense, we talk about the costs, we talk about the benefits
kind of in a fluffy ideological way. There are legitimate numbers and projections that we can look to, and so I just wanted to share some of that. I also, as somebody who is married to a member of the Society of Actuaries, I appreciate the addition of Article 3. I think it's really important. My husband has received paid family and medical leave through his organization twice. Once when we welcomed three children through the foster care system back in 2018 when I was in the middle of my first political campaign. And I needed that time. I needed that support. I took FMLA. I was working full time outside of the campaign at that point. Representative New Brindley, did you have a comment? That my husband, who's a member of the Society of Actuaries.
Hold up, let's not. I think we're going to keep it to the thing before the committee, but I do think that maybe we could try and keep comments on the side to a minimum and try and keep the comments to the measure under debate and not discuss other people's spouses. No, but I think that we can try and limit side conversations, particularly when they're audible, but particularly when other members are speaking.
And to be clear, there was no comment. Representative,
thank you. Representative Katiza Watum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important that we get that additional outside financial soundness study and how we move forward to ensure that this program functions well, it functions as it's designed, it stands the test of time, and it supports Minnesotans now and well into the future. Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to go back and hit on a couple of things that there were some questions on that I know from my following of this bill. First of all, to the question Representative New Brindley had posed about experience ratings and stuff and the idea that there might be some discrimination that would be going on in hiring certain persons based on gender. Well, those have been illegal and are illegal in the state of Minnesota and have been illegal under federal employment laws for quite a long time. There is also a cap, not in this bill, but in the Senate bill of 1.2%. So there is a starting point, a launching pad of 0.7% of payroll that we're going to be looking at in this bill. I sit on the local property tax division here in the legislature. One of the things that we are seeing right now is that properties in Ramsey and Hennepin County are experiencing a high vacancy rate. And we've discussed, and I've brought to the attention of the committee, that I think you're going to see a higher vacancy rate right around the capital area here. And the reason for that is you have the state of Minnesota leasing a lot of space right now, and they're still paying the leases on that space. Well, a lot of folks are working at home and accommodations are being made for them to be able to stay and work at home. We have buildings down here that are completely empty. As a matter of fact, there's a building that's being entertained that we would be using next year as this place undergoes renovation because there's just plenty of space there. So where am I going with this? Property taxes will be going up in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul because of this high vacancy rate. Those values of those properties will be going down. Adding on to this list, additional counties having to provide these benefits, cities having to provide these benefits, and school districts, which have been mentioned. But what we forgot is there's more in your property tax statement than meets the eye. There's also, in the Twin Cities area, a Met Council line. They will be having to accommodate. That means more for individuals and more for businesses. Where Representative Bernie Perryman and I are from, and Representative Wolgemont are from, there's also a Metro bus tax that's on the property taxes, which they will have to be complying with this, and it means individual property taxes will be going up, and so will the businesses be shouldering that. We oftentimes talk about the fact that we have a worker shortage here, and I'm just scratching my head, and I think all the bills that I've heard in committees where we're adding FTEs, we're adding FTEs, we're adding FTEs, and if we just had this plan, these workers would be able to come out and we'd have these workers. Where in this parallel universe or in this parallel economy am I missing those workers? Because I don't think they exist. I think we have a structural problem with too many jobs, not enough people, or not enough people who want to continue to stay working. And as a result of that, many businesses that are on the border will just jump right across the border, and go to a neighboring state where they don't have these regulations and probably be able to continue to do business in Minnesota. And some of that clientele will follow them. They will make those business decisions to move, and that's nothing that the state can control. There's some discussion about the state of California and what they have done and about how things have improved. Well, the state of California just lost some congressional seats because people are exiting that state because of overregulation that is happening in that state. And Mr. Chair, I'm going to end my discussion here on one more point, and then I have some questions on a provision that we adopted here in the amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wanted. The final comment that I'm going to make is we're going to start from scratch standing up a brand new regulatory authority here in the state of Minnesota. Right? We're going to stand it up. Where do we get the workers for that program since we can't get workers for other programs? Where do we get workers in all the other bills that we're looking at in growing employment here in the state of Minnesota? This is the time of the year that school districts send off layoff notices to their teachers under state law. I wonder how many school boards and how many organizations are sitting there right now kind of going, huh, I wonder how many notices we're going to have to be sending out in the future because of the cost increase to us as a district. Mr. Chair, on page 10 of the A33 amendment, lines 10.4 through 10.9 is, as Representative Katiza Watun, the Vice Chair, pointed out, is a carve-out. And this is a carve-out that is given to folks who are employed, who work in the construction industry. Two questions. Why the carve-out for these folks, and how expansive is the definition? Because I didn't see a definition in here of the construction industry. I did see that if it was those who are involved in a collective bargaining agreement, but not all contractors. I'm wanting to know what the delineation was for that and why we have this carve out for the folks in the construction industry. And does that mean landscaping? You're working on it? Does it mean road construction? Does it mean sewer, water, plumbing, electric? Where do we draw the line on this? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier, I see that you are joined by a new face at the table there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have someone to speak to this question.
Just identify yourself for the record and then you can go ahead and answer Representative Driscoll's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. My name is Melissa Heising. I'm with the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And could you repeat your question and point to the lines again?
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the A33 amendments, line 10.4 through 10.9, it carves out those in the construction industry who are covered by a collective bargaining agreement. And I'm kind of wondering if you can tell me what the definition of the construction industry is and why that group was chosen for a carve out on here for this benefit.
And Ms. Hanga, before you, I just want to say, I don't think there's a carve out here. There's an allowance of a waiver. So it's not that the bill doesn't apply. There's an allowance for a waiver. I think that's a different point. But Ms. Heisinger?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. If you're looking for the definition of construction industry, you'll find it on lines 5.25 to 5.28.
Yep.
So that is where it is defined. And then on lines 10.4 to 10.9, this refers to it's a waiver of a particular section of the bill that acknowledges the unique nature of job protections in the construction industry.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the testifier's answer on that.
And just before you continue, I'll note we're running a bit short on time. So
I have about 60 seconds left.
That's fine. Representative Driscoll.
Yep. As I wrap up my thoughts on this, this is a carve-out. Why is it a carve-out? Because somebody gets a benefit that somebody else doesn't. That's kind of the definition of a carve-out around here in the years I've been in the legislature. I fear that one of the ways that we attempt to try to solve the worker shortage in this state is we run half the businesses out of business, and those employees can go to work for the big corporate conglomerates that many in this chamber and in this house and in this body loathe because of the size of the employment that they are, size of employer, and taking away the mom and pop shop. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I encourage a no vote on the bill today. And I would like a roll call.
Roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Frazier, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, thank you for a robust and lengthy discussion. I appreciate that and for blessing me in my first time I'm bringing this bill before a committee. It was very enlightening. The one thing I will continue to go back to is that this is about workers. This is about retaining workers. This is about ensuring that workers that we have, and particularly in those small mom-and-pop shops that you're talking about, have the ability to stay connected to the workforce. When they need to take time off to care for themselves or for their children or for an ailing family member, they will have the ability to do that without having to be concerned about financial ruin. That's an important thing. Regardless of what you think about this bill does not create the need for leave. That will still happen. People will still get pregnant. People will still have babies. People will still have ailing family members that they will need to attend to. And this bill is not an outlier. That's clear. This bill is not an outlier. It doesn't provide the most leave in the country. It doesn't cost the most in the country. Per about right in the middle of the pack. This bill was clearly about supporting workers, and we all heard the compelling testimony saying that we want to support our workers. We made the amendment that was adopted today was in large part about continued conversations that we're having with businesses, large and small, to address their issues. So we can't say that we're not having these conversations. We can't say that we're not trying to address the concerns and get the best bill possible to ensure that we're helping our workers. If you want to help workers, if you want to make sure that we maintain and have a pool of workers, treat them good, treat them well, provide them with benefits that they need. That's what this bill does. So I'm going to urge a yes vote, and I'm looking forward to continued conversations in other committee stops.
All right, thank you, Representative Frazier. I will renew my motion that House File 2 has amended be recommended to be referred to the Workforce Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotizza-Watoon?
Aye.
Cotizza-Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
O'Driscoll, no. Representative Bierman?
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Dotseth?
No.
Dotseth, no. Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Cagle?
Yes.
Cagle, aye. Representative Kraft?
Aye.
Kraft, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative New Brindley?
No.
New Brindley, no. Representative Niska?
No.
Niska, no. Representative Perryman?
No.
Perryman, no. Representative Farr?
No.
Farr, no. Representative Tapke?
Yes.
Tapke, aye.
There being 8 ayes and 6 nays, the motion fails, and House File 2, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Workforce Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We have no more business before us today. I do not expect any further hearings this year, or this session anyway, you never know at the legislature. So I would just like to pause for a brief moment and thank first our committee members for their excellent work. I really think that we've had good discussions here. I appreciate the bills brought forward. But I also want to take a moment and thank our excellent staff that have made this a phenomenally run and productive committee. We are always joined by Lori Pompu and Ashley Eng. From House Research and House Fiscal, but we have many other House researchers who have joined us, including Ms. James today, but others on other days. We have had the great service of our page, Chris Ohlendorf. Thank you, sir. There you are. I appreciate you very much. We have great researchers on the partisan side, Casey Peterson, Eric Anderson. Thank you both for your phenomenal work. And then, of course, the people who sit to my left and right every time we meet, without whom we would be totally lost, Mr. Dockendorf and Mr. Brown. Thank you so much for your work. Really appreciate that. And with that, I have nothing further. I don't know, Representative O'Driscoll, if you wanted to say anything.
There's a saying around here that everything's been said, but not everybody said it, so I'll just underscore your comments, Mr. Chair.
Well,
thank
Mr.
you.
Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, one thing hasn't been said, and that is to thank you for running a really great committee. So that does need to be added, and I'm sure I speak for all of us.
Thank you so much, Chair. I appreciate that. High compliment coming from a fellow chair like you. And with that, the committee is adjourned.